You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon. I'm Louis Sines, your host for Perspectives, and joining us today is Dr. Bernie Page. Dr. Page is a veterinarian, and we decided to invite him over because, we've had programs in the past where we deal with different diseases and patients, doctors, but we also forget, and how can we forget, that we have, of course, man's best friend, the dog. And today we have with us Dr. Page, and Dr. Page is a veterinarian. And first of all, we'd like to take the time to thank him to take time out of his busy schedule to be with us. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Always glad for the opportunity to do what we can to help prevent problems for our animal friends. And there are a lot of things that are come up during the warm weather that I think people need to be aware of.
And one of the things that you talked about, Bernie, a lot of people have, like everything else, stereotypes or misconceptions that there are only certain things that they need to be aware of during warm weather, and primarily is, okay, make sure that you roll down the window or that you don't lock a dog inside a car.
Well, that's, of course, the very baseline, and that's absolutely true. Even a modestly warm day, if you shut your car and lock it, the temperature starts to soar in there. If you just want to find out, just take your car out and set it in the sunlight and put one of those basting thermometers in your windshield and shut the door and watch how quickly that rises. On a warm day, temperature is getting anywhere near, 90 to 100 degrees. If you lock that car up, it'll be 140, 150 degrees in there in just a matter of minutes. That's intolerable for anything to survive that very long. So those are always problems. People go in the store and they forget that it's, takes a little bit longer, but animals don't tolerate heat in those situations very well at all.
Now, a lot of people have, they say, well, dogs were meant to be outside. So our dog is an outside dog. And, of course, a lot of people have inside dogs. And the problem is an outside dog, you have to be careful where that dog is put, where you have, if you have a dog run, if you have a one of those igloos, whatever, you have to be careful where you set that, correct?
Well, absolutely. We have to realize that, dogs are a ways away from the wolves and foxes and coyotes, and left to themselves, animals will seek shade or be pretty inactive during the heat of the day. But if they are trapped out on a concrete run or somewhere like that, there's no way to get out of that heat. And remember, they have fur coats on, and this adds to the problem. A thick-bodied dog is much worse off than a short-haired dog. But nevertheless, in direct sunlight, dogs and cats do not do well. Let's say if they have some ability to get out of that heat, that's good. But they really don't go in doghouses. If you ever put your hand inside an igloo in a hot day, it's like inside of a tin can. It's way too hot. So they need shade and they need water.
What about shaving dogs? Because sometimes when a person takes a dog to the groomer, they'll shave the dog. And I'm wondering, is that putting them in danger of getting sunburned or hurt in some way?
Well, it depends on how short you shave the hair. Yes, some dogs have very, very light skin. And if you shave too closely, yes, they can sunburn, and that is an issue. Now, you don't need to shave them that closely to be able to do it. You don't shave against the grain, and most groomers are aware of what is appropriate for a length on an animal. You're just trying to get rid of that heavy hair coat to allow them to be more comfortable in warm weather. Dogs like chows and things like that that just have that exuberant, thick hair coat really need help. The other thing a lot of people don't realize is that the breed of dog that you have makes quite a difference in their ability to tolerate heat. Thin-bodied dogs and things like that can tolerate a lot more heat than a thick-bodied dog. The worst of all situations are these breeds they call the short-nosed breeds, the boxers, Pekingese, bulldogs, and what we call in medicine the brachiocephalic breeds. Very short noses, very thick throats, they have difficulty breathing under ideal conditions. And dogs don't deal with heat the same way we do. We perspire, and dogs lack that ability except for their nose and their foot pads. The only way they can cool themselves is by panting out the hot air that's inside their body. Their normal body temperature is 101 to 102. And they exchange that air that's inside them at that temperature for the cooler air that's outside. But as you can readily see, the minute that temperature begins to get up as high or higher than their body temperature, that doesn't work. So their body temperature, they'll just start overheating. And those real thick body, and bulldog is probably your number one breed for getting heat stroke in the summer. They just cannot tolerate much heat.
Is that why a couple of years ago, somebody from our church had a friend over at their house, and they brought a big bulldog. But he wasn't big. He seemed like he was overweight, unhealthy. Mm-hmm. And the poor animal sounded almost like he was having an asthma attack. He was struggling to breathe.
Well, you know, these breeds that they call the brachiocephalics actually have dwarfism. That is a dwarfism gene that makes them gives them that appearance, and it causes a lot of problems. They have a lot of difficulty with excessive tissue in the throat, so they actually kind of snore when they breathe. In spite of the fact that they have this huge, huge neck, their trachea, their windpipe, is actually very small compared to, say, a hound or something like that. And so you've got this thick-bodied dog with this huge neck and all this folds of skin in their throat or tissue in their throat that's obstructing their breathing. And then they're breathing through this little McDonald's-sized straw windpipe. And, those things, you just keep adding one more brick on the load, and they just cannot handle it. They can't breathe hard enough and fast enough to not keep from overheating.
El Paso is just it's hot. Or hotter in the summer, but in some areas, you know, in the Upper Valley, it's cooler sometimes. So some doctors will say that depending on what part of town you live, your pet could be susceptible to certain types of diseases.
Well, this is true. Summertime raises a lot of disease considerations. When it gets warm and the weather's beginning to warm up now, animals that aren't well contained, and we have a lot of those around, move around a lot. And as a result, disease spreads, and we have much more disease beginning about this time of year. We are on the front end of the problems that we have. When it warms up about this time of year, some of the diseases like distemper and parvovirus really begin to emerge. And it is also a kind of a breeding season for both dogs and cats. So there's a lot of activity going on around there, a lot of animals moving around. Some of these diseases like distemper are airborne, and therefore during the windy season that can be spread around. So warmer weather brings with it oftentimes a pretty large increase in the diseases that we see in the area.
One of the things that we discussed as well is unfortunately, this is just serious among the human population, and it affects everybody. But cancer, it seems like just about every other person now has come down with cancer, or somebody with cancer. Is it true that dogs, as they get older, are more susceptible to cancer?
Yes, it pretty much mimics what we see in people. The older animals, there's a lot of various kinds of cancer in dogs and cats, and we do see that. So it is not unique to just people. And the older and the longer an animal lives, the more, the higher the risk that they are going to develop some type of cancer. Related to heat, believe it or not, skin cancers are not uncommon in dogs. And we have some of those dogs that love to lay upside down in the sun. A basset hound would be a good example of that. And a lot of them have very pink skin on their stomach and this type of thing. And that constant exposure to sun carries with it a risk of developing skin cancer. Dogs and cats, neither one have any ability to tan the way we do. And so they just continue to irritate that pink skin, and problems result from that. Other animals, you see some dogs and things like that with noses that are getting very, very raw and irritated. That also can be from chronic sun exposure. And cats that are white cats, the tips of their ears are very commonly afflicted with skin cancers.
You said that sometimes if a dog develops a lump of some kind. It could be just something as simple as just fatty tissue, and it doesn't always have to be serious.
Well, there's of course benign and malignant growths, and there are a number of benign growths, and not every growth represents a real serious threat to an animal. But it's very hard to give any kind of guidelines that will help you without having it looked at by a professional. So I'd recommend if you have something like that, then have it examined by a veterinarian. Some of the things that look innocent are actually quite dangerous, and some things that look not so good are really not – don't pose that much of a health threat.
Bernie, people might wonder, what about pet insurance? Why aren't there more companies out there offering pet insurance? And would it work, you as a professional?
There are pet insurances out there, and some people avail themselves of that. And I think it's a good thing. Now, there are some restrictions on that. And again, it's not as comprehensive as it is in, you know, human medicine. We've had insurance companies around for a long, long time. This is still a relatively newcomer to the scene, and so it is not as common, but it is getting more common. And I encourage people to look and see what is available out there, because it is very helpful. Over the life of an animal, if you're taking care of your animal and going routinely to veterinarians, I think it's a money saver and also provides you a good level of protection against, you know, serious health problems that can get to be quite costly if there's some real issues going on. So I think it is warranted, and they also are very helpful for vaccinations and things like that if you're keeping up on it.
We know about people who have moved here from, you know, Minnesota, from Iowa, and, of course, in the summers, you know, and in the when it's nice and warm out here, they love it because they hate the winters up there. And the same thing goes for dogs, as you mentioned. Some dogs are just beautiful, huskies. Our dog is half Labrador and half a Shiba Inu. And so I'm wondering, is it okay to have those kind of dogs in this kind of weather? Do they adjust, or is it something that we shouldn't be trying to do?
Well, we have so many of them here, and granted, a husky or something like that is designed, obviously, for cold weather. They have a very thick hair coat, but usually they're not a real heavy breed. You know, we see St. Bernards here, and they're, you know, it's a big dog, shorter nose and thick-bodied. If you're aware of what your dog's requirements are, you know, now, if you're going to keep them outside all the time, it really becomes a serious factor. If an animal is allowed ability to go in and out, you know, a dog door, in other words, or something like this, most of them can do quite well in El Paso, and many of them do very well. But it does require – you have to look at your yard. Is it a rock yard? Is there landscaping? Is there shade throughout the day, especially in the high temperature times? Are we talking about a concrete run? Are we talking about a shady yard? Those things are all factors that play into that. And then as your dog older, the older they get, the less they can move around, the less they tolerate, you know, adverse conditions.
Tell us about dog years. How does that work?
It's a sliding scale. And, you know, the old standard of 1 to 7 is not really accurate. Usually they say the first 2 years is about equivalent to about 18 to 20 years of our life. And after that, they slow it down to about 4. You know, they go for 6 years for the first couple of years, and it begins to drop to 1 per 4 years after that. It varies a little bit. The giant breeds, the real large breeds, and Great Danes and Wolfhounds and St. Bernards do not live as long as the smaller breeds. Chihuahuas and small terriers and things like that can live much longer as a rule than the large breed dog. So there are actually charts, and you can probably Google this and get a feel for what size your dog is and things like that, and get a pretty good idea of how to rank your dog's age with a equivalent human age.
We talked at the beginning about heat and warmth, and they encourage us, doctors encourage us, to drink plenty of water, not sodas, but how much water should a pet be drinking?
Well, they need access to water. And on a hot day, they're going to drink quite a bit. If they're outside, again, you know, there's not a one answer fits all, because some dogs are very active and running around, and because they pant, they lose a lot of fluid by that constant breathing in and out like that. So there's actually a good deal of evaporation that occurs in their lungs by breathing like that. So an active dog is going to need far more water than an inactive dog. And you have to measure that. But I mean, a bucket full of water out there kept somewhere where it's shady, where it's not real hot, should be enough. Now, you know, need to have it somewhere where it's not knocked over. You know, dogs play in water and do things like that. And, you know, the sad thing is people go to work, and if a dog is able to knock their water over at 8:30 in the morning and you're not home till 6 on a summer day, that is a long time to be without water.
I know there are a lot of people out there who are saying, what about cats? I like cats. You haven't said anything about cats. So what about cats? You know, they talk about cats having 9 lives, and mm-hmm. the fact that a cat can endure anything. Should cats be treated a lot differently than another pet?
Well, cats are lower maintenance in a lot of ways, and most people that have cats as pets keep them inside, simply because there's a lot of risk with feral cats out there, and cats are virtually impossible to keep in a yard unless they're on a leash or something, or, you know, some kind of way of controlling them, because they can go over fences and they can get through almost anything. So if a cat gets out, they're going to wander around, and their risk of running into problems with feral cats or other issues, dogs and things like that, goes up considerably. So we don't have quite the problem. Number one, they're smaller body size, and they can find shade in the smallest spaces. So heat stroke in cats is not as big a problem as it is in dogs, simply because they're just generally not outside. Cats are more nocturnal than dogs, and they will lay around all day long, and then they get a little more active in the evening. So while wild dogs are more nocturnal, we've turn dogs into a daytime animal.
As far as what we feed them, chocolate is not good for dogs, I understand. And what about other types of junk food or table food?
Well, again, this is a real problem. Now, dogs that routinely eat table food sometimes can tolerate more. But in response to that, when you think about feeding a dog food, and that's what they're getting the same meal every single day. Then when you vary that diet suddenly with Thanksgiving and a bunch of food that's rich food and quite different from what they're used to eating, it's going to upset their digestive system. And it can cause some serious problems with them. I don't recommend it. I don't have a huge objection to a small mouthful or treat or something like that, but to give them a big glob of food that they're not, you know, even remotely accustomed to is dangerous. Dogs get into a lot by themselves. They find things, and chocolate is a real threat to dogs. There's a product in there called theobromide, which can be at high levels very dangerous or lethal to a dog. And with Easter just passing and Valentine's Day, but these are big chocolate days, but holidays are big times. I really recommend, boy, just be very, very judicious about that. And dogs love fat. They're attracted to fat, fatty foods, the way, you know, kids are attracted to sugar. However, it is one of the best things I know to create a pancreatitis, or a vicious abdominal vomiting and serious disease in dogs, to give an animal that is not used to a lot of fat a big fatty meal.
Tell us about the chip. How is that working?
The microchip, I think it is a very, very valuable tool, because this is a permanently implanted chip. There are a number of companies that make it. They have universal scanners now that are found through all animal control shelters. Veterinarians have those. If your animal is lost, it is a permanent identification. They're nationally registered, can be locally registered, and that way, if your animal is found with a microchip, they can find out who it belongs to and reconnect the pet with the owner. One of the most valuable places has been during these hurricanes and things like that, where animals are lost or abandoned or something, and they're separated and relocating when there's hundreds and hundreds of them out there in temporary shelters is very difficult. But a microchip tells you who it belongs to, and it's much easier to reconnect. It is actually required by ordinance in El Paso that animals be, dogs and cats, be microchipped. But I will say that despite the not only the legal aspect of it, but just simply for your dog could be taken to, you know, to Ohio, and it's still anyone who scans that dog can tell whose animal that is.
What about taking care of the dog? And what I mean by that is, of course, you know, making sure that they don't have puppies constantly. Mm-hmm. And when, you know, when children or even us adults, when we see the puppy, they're just so adorable, mm-hmm. and we have to have them. But we forget that these puppies grow up, and sometimes they grow up pretty big. And so then comes where the child is not as interested anymore. It's your turn to take it to care of the dog. No, I did it yesterday. And so all of a sudden, that dog becomes kind of neglected.
Well, this is one of the national problems we face. Pet overpopulation is huge. And not spaying or neutering your animal is really contributory to that. There are a lot of reasons to spay and neuter your animal besides just having you know, control of breeding, because especially in dogs, an unspayed female is prone to a lot of serious health problems later in life, regardless of whether she's ever had a litter or not. Males' behavior and activity, intending to jump and get away, and aggression are dropped down quite a bit by having them neutered. But we just have a huge national problem with pet overpopulation. And as you say, they're cute when they're puppies, but not all. It's hard to find homes for all of them. And sometimes they don't get the attention that they need. Somebody takes an impulse buying a puppy because it's so cute and then loses interest somewhere along the line. So we do strongly encourage spaying and neutering an animal while it's young. It is a myth that they have to have a litter or they even should go through heat before they're spayed or neutered. It's getting very, very popular and wise to spay them much earlier in life than we used to do that.
And buying, now we add another problem, because there are puppy mills out there.
Well, there are puppy mills and just a lot of just accidental breedings, and people say, oh, I can't, you know, keep 8 puppies, and so they do this. That roadside selling, by the way, is forbidden, and so you're subject to fines and this type of thing. But yes, if you're going to get a puppy and you want to start with a good situation, there needs to be a little bit of looking into where this puppy was, what kind of ancestry they have. They have congenital inherited problems, so a little forethought needs to go into, you know, what you're getting. And if you're in an apartment, buying a large breed dog may not be a good idea. So if you're going to get a pet, really do some thinking before you just – because your emotions will lead you, and it's hard not to. I have the same thing. Oh, that is really cute. Wouldn't it be fun to have that one? But there are a lot of things that you really have to consider. It's like taking on a roommate. And, you know, it's – they live a while, and you need to be prepared for that.
One of the things that that we've heard, and we've heard, you know, stories on NPR, dramatic stories on you know, Reader's Digest and stuff like that, that dogs, pets, etc., can be very therapeutic for people, old people, young people, but also in many instances they've saved a lot of lives.
Well, that's really an interesting topic and subject, and the human-animal bond is huge. The response, there's all kinds of scientific evidence to show that just having a dog in a room lowers people's blood pressure. They tend to argue and disagree less. Animals have been used many times in dealing with troubled children, even prisoners and things like that, that they are a very effective way of raising social consciousness and actually sociability among people by allowing especially troubled children to care for a pet. There are a number of animals that are therapy animals, and it's kind of amazing. There are dogs that can actually tell when a person is going to have a heart attack. There are dogs that can tell when a person is going to have a seizure, dogs that can actually sniff cancer and things like that. And in many cases, those people that have seizure problems, heart problems and things like that have been now, these animals are highly trained, but they have been, they have gotten all these animals and they have saved many lives. It's amazing how they do that, and time doesn't permit us to go into how all that works. But I'll tell you, there is no machine on this planet that can predict some of these things as well as a dog.
Is it true or is this just myth that sometimes we've heard, of course, that an animal will look like its owner, you know, and sometimes they do in the pictures that we see. But this, I'm not sure if it's a myth or it's just something that people have talked about, the fact that let's say you develop heart problems or mm-hmm. you develop cancer, God forbid, then the dog will mimic or take on some of those symptoms itself.
Well, in many cases, the dogs are so closely bonded to people that they will suffer. Now, whether they'll get the exact same ailment or not, but they are acutely aware oftentimes of the mental state of the owner. A dog that's closely bonded to person will stress over whatever is stressing the owner. And those times of high stress where health is really an issue and life and death issues and those type of things are well documented that it is stressful for the animal. However, the animal is oftentimes proven to be a huge comfort and therapeutic outlet for people, especially the elderly who are sometimes isolated.
Bernie, if people are interested in finding out more about animals or about veterinarians, is there a website that you could recommend for them to go to?
There are a number of them. Most people are – I'm not the highest tech person on the planet by any means. I'm just about one gene away from a chimpanzee when it comes to those sort of things. But the American Veterinary Medical Association, Humane Society, a number of those have national websites. You just start Googling. And now I will say this, you know, when you get on the internet, you have to be a little careful. Not every site is a reputable site, and you can get nonsense out there. But if you go to the recognized sites, you know, as far as, you know, what is out there, animals in particular, there's a vast amount of information out there. If you're interested in becoming a veterinarian, then I would recommend actually Googling the websites of colleges that have colleges of veterinary medicine. In Texas, Texas A&M would be the one, but there are a number of states. Although they're surprising, there are a number of states without any veterinary college. We're a small profession. There are only about 20 veterinary colleges in the country. But nevertheless, you can just Google. Most anybody, any young person who's interested in that is quite capable of getting on there and pulling it up and seeing what the requirements are for becoming a veterinarian.
Bernie, thank you very much for being with us here today. We've been visiting with Dr. Bernie Page, veterinarian, telling us a little bit about what to watch out for this summer, taking care of our pets. So thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Perspectives is taped and produced at KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.